And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We are committed to, as a mission statement, bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And today is no exception. We've been doing this for a long time, but I am so excited about the podcast today. Before I introduce my guest for today's podcast, I want to mention something that kept going through my head as I began reading his book, and it is the statement of King Solomon. The wisest man who ever lived said, "Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares its food in the summer and gathers its provision in the harvest." So here you have King Solomon telling you to get off the couch, get outside, and observe ants. So what in the world can you learn from an ant? Well, we're going to find out today what you can learn from the ingenious, complex program behaviors of ants. My guest today is Eric Castle. He is an expert in navigation systems. He has had a longtime interest in animal navigation and has more than 40 years of experience in systems engineering, which is directly related to aircraft navigation and safety. Eric has served as an engineering consultant for NASA and the Federal Aviation Administration and has developed computer algorithms for safety systems. Now, algorithms is a very important word. We're going to be talking about algorithms because the title of his book is Animal Algorithms, Evolution and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts. And before I get to Eric, I was fascinated as I was reading through the endorsements for this book to run across a man by the name of Gunther Beckley, who does this stirring endorsement. I won't read the whole endorsement, but in essence, what he says is that this book, the book we're going to be talking about today, is another welcome and highly recommended step toward an overdue paradigm change in modern biology. Now, that's quite a mouthful. And particularly when you start to realize who Gunther Beckley is, he's a German paleoentomologist who specializes in the fossil history and systematics of insects, and he's worked as a curator in the Department of Paleontology at the State Museum of Natural History in Stuttgart, Germany. And the reason this endorsement is so stunning is in 2009, which was the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth, Beckley curated a museum exhibit that featured not only Darwin's work, but also books by intelligent design theorists. And he cleverly featured a balance scale. On one side, you had Darwin's Origin of Species all by itself. On the other side, you had the intelligent design books written by a wide variety of authors. So you had all these books on one side, and then you had Darwin's Origin of Species on the other. And his point was that Darwin's Origin of Species outweighed everything else. But here you now have an ID skeptic who's endorsing this incredible book. So he was a former ID skeptic. He is now endorsing the work of Eric Castle. Eric, it is great to have you on the podcast today. I was so fascinated by your book because you're taking things that we ought to be observing and you're making these things observable in the sense that you're explaining things that we don't normally see.
Well, thanks, Hank, for having me on the program. Yes, that was one of the aspects that attracted me and encouraged me to write the book from that aspect, was that many of the things that are discussed in the book are things that are easily observable today. They don't rely so much, for example, on the fossil record things that may have happened millions of years in the past. These are behaviors that animals exhibit that, again, are very easily observable.
And you start with an ant. And if we observe an ant, like Solomon told us to observe an ant, we see that they have phenomenal navigation skills. And yet they have a brain smaller than a sesame seed. And with this brain, they perform extraordinary mental feats. Give us some kind of a sense of what happens when you watch an ant and you really observe what that ant is doing.
Well, there's actually two different aspects of ant behavior that are discussed in the book. One is the social behaviors that you hinted about a minute ago, and those are complex because the ants live in these highly complex social colonies and exhibit a lot of different behaviors, and so there's complexity in how those behaviors are controlled. The other aspect is some particular ants and their navigation abilities. And what I describe in the book is how, in particular, this one ant that's called a desert ant, it lives in the, as the name implies, the deserts in Africa, that have navigation systems that rival the systems that we use on commercial aircraft today. And they use a number of different sensors, as do our aircraft systems, and they employ complex algorithms to guide their navigation system. It really is amazing when you compare the two side by side.
You also talk about leaf cutter ant colonies, and you say that's your favorite, one of the seven wonders of the animal world.
Yeah, the leaf cutters are, again, it's another behavior that when you examine it closely, it's ants that are working together in unison to cut down leaves and transport them to their home nests. And it's a process that involves, again, the ants in the colony working together in unison. It's not just some solitary ant out there doing these behaviors. They somehow, and we don't understand how, actually, how they coordinate all that complex activity.
And you have ants that live in trees that are able to take growing leaves without taking them away from the tree at all. They're growing. They take those leaves and they're able to glue them together. And if the leaves are jagged, have jagged edges, they're able to trim them and then make a nest that is about the size of a soccer ball, something like that. I mean, that's an incredible thing if you see them doing this in a social behavior and then engineering something that is absolutely astounding.
Right, yeah. Again, it's a social behavior that involves activities amongst the ants in the colony working together, and the ants you're talking about are weaver ants. And the aspect that you touched on briefly, to me, is the most fascinating and challenging from a scientific point of view, is how to explain how ants and other animals, other insects that I talk about, with such tiny brains, are able to exhibit such complex behaviors. It's well beyond anybody's ability to understand at this point in time how that is even possible.
And yet there is an explanation that is given in the neo-Darwinian mind. It's an unguided, purposeless process that leads us to these complex programmed behaviors.
Well, exactly. I mean, that is the reigning paradigm in biology, that it's all due to, you know, just random mutations and natural selection, and that process is capable of generating not just complex biological systems physically, but also complex biological behaviors. And that includes, again, these behaviors occurring in such tiny brains. Now, you can take that Darwinian paradigm and think, okay, maybe that's somewhat plausible, but when you examine how these behaviors occur, to me, there's several different aspects to this that are very mysterious. One, what is the origin of the information that even defines the behaviors in the first place? That's a major challenge for a Darwinian point of view. Second, how are those behaviors and this information contained in the genome? that's something that is very mysterious, and we understand very little at this point about that. And then third, how are these behaviors and that information somehow encoded in these brains, and again, in such tiny brains with such efficiency? You must have an extremely efficient neural network that somehow takes that information and encodes that behavior into the brain.
Yeah, and it's not just ants. I mean, there's so many things we ought to be observing. Another one of the tiny animals that you talk about in your book is the honeybee. And they have an amazing mini brain as well. And through that small brain, they are able to do these complex behaviors that include navigation, which is astounding. And I think perhaps the most astounding thing that you point to is the waggle dance of the honeybee, the second most information-rich exchange in the animal world, second only to human language. I mean, that's astounding in and of itself.
Yeah, exactly. And that's an observation that scientists have made for quite a while, going back to the scientist that originally discovered that, Carl von Frisch. And what they're indicating is that the information that's contained in what is essentially a communication system, where ants are able to communicate with each other, defining navigation information, you know, where to search for food, where to go look for another nest. There's a significant amount of information contained in the waggle dance, and they are able to communicate it. Again, this is something that's taking place between animals with extremely tiny brains, but it's all encoded into those brains somehow and transmitted, again, genetically from, you know, from one generation to the next. And again, you get back to the same question: what is the origin of the information that defines all of that? And that is a major mystery.
I mean, this waggle dance gives you direction, gives you distance. It conveys where the food source is and the distance it takes to get to the food source. I mean, it's just absolutely astounding. And you also write about the Arctic tern. And I think this is particularly intoxicating when you stop to think about the fact that an Arctic tern might travel as many as 30,000 miles and over a lifetime, maybe a million miles. Talk about a frequent flyer.
Exactly. Yeah, the tern and a number of other birds do these significantly long distance migrations, many of them going from one pole to the other on the Earth annually. And one of the challenges about such behaviors from an engineering and navigation point of view is, how do they do these migrations so accurately? And we've learned a lot over the last couple of decades about the navigation abilities of a number of different animals, including many of the migrating birds. But we still don't really understand completely how that information is contained in the genome. For example, many of these migrations are inherited. So somehow they arose in the past, we don't know how, and that destination for the migration is contained, we believe. Again, that's really kind of conjecture at this point, but the assumption is it is contained in the genome and then transmitted to their offspring. And so in the case of birds, when they're hatched, they actually have that information, and they were able to migrate to a specific destination without learning anything, without any information being conveyed from the parents. They are just born knowing where to migrate to. It is just, it's just astonishing.
Did Darwin know anything about genetics?
Well, no, of course not. He was well before Mendel and the work that went on later on about genetics. So he really didn't know much of anything about how genetics worked.
Is that giving Darwin a bit of a pass? I mean, at least you can understand how he would have come up with a theory, or popularized a theory, I should say. And if he had known about genetics, perhaps he would have modified his view somewhat.
Well, I think that's certainly true, because he got a number of things wrong in terms of genetics specifically. For example, it wasn't just him, but other scientists of that era believed in the blending of characteristics, where they thought that a particular characteristic would be transmitted in sexual reproduction from the two parents, that those characteristics would blend in some way in the offspring. Well, of course, following the work of Mendel, we learned that that's not the case. So he was really off on that aspect of genetics. Another aspect that I don't think, and biologists acknowledge that that's the case, that Darwin obviously was ignorant about that, but so were many other people at that time. Another interesting aspect related to genetics is so-called Lamarckian evolution. So that's a theory that so-called acquired characteristics, where an animal could acquire a particular characteristic during their lifetime and then transmit that to their offspring. And it had some support at the time of Darwin. In fact, even after Darwin, some people continued to believe in that. Darwin actually was a big advocate of that. In The Origin of Species, he actually writes about that and provides support for that point of view a number of different times, and in particular in relation to animal behaviors. He thought Lamarckism was actually a potential explanation for the way a number of animal behaviors might have developed over time and evolved. So again, but that's an area that it's interesting to me as I did the research for this book, to find that biologists have completely overlooked that aspect of Darwin's point of view, that he actually did become an advocate for Lamarckism, and again, particularly in regard to behaviors. But of course, that was pretty soundly discredited eventually also.
Yeah. Why did you focus on less advanced animals? I mean, what was the reason that that's your focus in this book?
Well, that's a great question. Yeah. And the simple reason is because there's a big difference between behaviors that are instinctual or innate. In other words, a behavior that an animal might exhibit almost from the moment of birth, versus behaviors that require some learning. So more advanced animals, i.e. mammals, for example, have brains that are large enough and are able to learn a significant number of things over time and learn behaviors. Whereas what I wanted to focus on was behaviors that are essentially programmed into the animal's behavior repertoire almost from the moment of birth. And so by doing that, it removed any possible explanation of the role of learning for these behaviors, in that they have to be, and then pretty much I was trying to focus on behaviors that, again, are innate, and so therefore they must be pre-programmed in some way.
You've sort of done this already, but perhaps you can really zero in on this moniker. If you read your book, one of the things that you come away with is three words that are imprinted on the canvas of your consciousness: complex programmed behaviors. Unpack that a little more for those listening in, because I think this would be an incentive for people to read this book.
Yes, that's the term that I use throughout the book, complex programmed behavior. And the reason is, again, I wanted to focus on certain kinds of behaviors that had a characteristic that indicated that there was some programming aspect to it that weren't just simple behaviors. So, for example, take the word complex. That I want to distinguish those from simple behaviors that are basically just reflexes. Or in psychologist terms, they talk about Pavlovian type of behaviors, where there's a stimulus and then a response. Again, those are, for the most part, those tend to be simple behaviors. I wanted to steer clear of that and talk about behaviors that were more complex than that. programmed infers that there's an aspect of the behavior that is, again, it's innate, and it means that it's involved not necessarily an algorithm per se. Then most of us tend to, well, I'm an engineer, so that's my background, but I tend to typically think of an algorithm as a computer algorithm. It's not just simply limited to a computer type algorithm or a piece of software code, but it could be other things beyond that. A specific example might be, in the case of the social insects, they have a number of decision algorithms. In other words, they have a large repertoire of behaviors that they perform in the social colony, but the control of that is done through, apparently, a number of decision algorithms that exist in their brain. In other words, they make a decision based on some environmental condition, like they need food, or they need to go search for a new nest, or tend to the queen, etc. So there's a decision process involved there, and so that means there's some kind of an algorithm, we don't know what it is, but it's somehow helping that animal make a decision of, do I do behavior A, B, C, which one? So there's a choice involved. So that also meets the category of a complex algorithm.
We were talking earlier on about the Arctic tern, and I want to quote Darwin here, just as you do in the book, where Darwin says that a human being cannot, on his first trial, let's say, make something like a canoe. But a beaver, on the other hand, can make a dam. A spider can make a wonderful spider web. And they can do it the first time. This is astonishing when you have an Arctic tern who can determine a navigation that's based on the magnetic field of the Earth. I mean, when you think about that, that's a mind blower. But that's pre-programmed. That's what you're talking about when you're talking about algorithms.
Yes, exactly. Again, these are algorithms that are all pre-programmed. Somehow they reside in, you know, neuroscientists would talk about this in terms of a neural network in the brain, which logically makes sense. At least as far as we know today, that's the most plausible explanation. So in other words, they are hardwired, these behaviors, from the moment that the animal is developed and is born. Not only is the, let's say it is a neural network and the brain is hardwired, but there's a lot of aspects to that that are pre-programmed as well. In other words, it's in some cases, specifically in reference to navigation ability, there's actually mathematics involved. Now, the animal is actually taking some piece of information, typically a sensor, like a magnetic sensor, for example, using that information and actually computing a navigation path. In other words, okay, I have some information. My sensor's telling me where true north is, for example, but I want to fly southwest. So there's a computation there that says, okay, I have a piece of sensor information. Now I have to compute, where is my destination? So there's a number of different aspects of this that are well beyond our comprehension about how animals are doing all of that. Again, particularly in regards to these insects like ants and bees, where they have such tiny brains.
And butterflies as well. One of the fascinating parts of your book is the explication of the monarch butterfly. I've often been fascinated, and I've talked in various lectures about butterflies. What happens when a caterpillar goes through metamorphosis? You have this incredible transformation that takes place where from the caterpillar, you now have a butterfly. The caterpillar has eyes that can distinguish between light and dark. The butterfly has a field of vision and color acuity that exceeds even that of a human being. The caterpillar doesn't have wings. The butterfly does. The caterpillar doesn't have a proboscis. The butterfly does. So you have this mysterious molecular mixture that's in the chrysalis, and out of that comes a butterfly. And it's absolutely astounding when you think about metamorphosis and how that has to be explained by the Darwinian evolutionary process. I mean, it seems impossible. It's one thing to explain the caterpillar and all of its complexities, but out of that you have metamorphosis in a butterfly.
Yes, and one of the mysteries about all that is the fact that essentially what you have is two entirely separate genomes. In other words, you have a genome that defines a caterpillar, and then you have a genome that defines the butterfly, but they all reside within the genome of the animal. And somehow or another, there's a switch between which part of the genome is activated at some particular time. Yeah, the whole metamorphosis is a really big challenge for Darwinian evolution.
I love the fact that on the cover of your book, you have the loggerhead sea turtle. And I think this is really interesting to talk about the kind of ingenious built-in compass that a loggerhead turtle has.
Right, and the loggerheads are one of the animals that there's some research that's indicating that they have a particular unique ability for navigation, and that is one of the big ways of distinguishing between different types of navigation is a navigation system where you're flying, or in the case of a turtle, you're swimming in a certain direction. So in other words, going east, west, etc., toward some general sense of direction. However, in the case of the loggerhead and some lobsters that have this ability, there's an indication that they actually have a map sense. So in other words, typically when we think of a map, we think of a two-dimensional map, but it's based on latitude and longitude. So you're able to get a two-dimensional representation of space, and you can go from destination A to B based on the coordinates within that system. What's been found, and we didn't know until very recently, that some animals actually do have a capability that appears to be a form of a map sense like that. And the theory is, and there is some, again, some research indicating it's actually based on different aspects of the Earth's magnetic field. So in other words, typically when we think of the magnetic field of the Earth, we think of just a compass giving you north and south, you know, where the pole is located, for example. But the magnetic field actually has more information than that, because it depends on both the vertical and horizontal direction of the field. So as you move from one of the poles toward the equator, the vertical inclination changes. So it moves as you traverse between the equator and the pole. And so the theory is that these animals are actually able to use that information. And not only does it give you north-south information, but there's also some indication that because the Earth's magnetic field actually does vary geographically, there's a number of things that cause it to change slightly as you move, for example, over the ocean or near one of the continents. There's a lot of geometric anomalies. But the belief is that you can actually create a two-dimensional map based on that information, and that's what animals like the loggerhead sea turtle and some others appear to be using as a form of navigation, which is, again, this is something a few years ago nobody thought was even theoretically possible, but now there's some research indicating, yeah, that it in fact might be the case.
I want to really zero in on navigation in general, and then in specific, the different kind of navigational capabilities that these animals have. So you make the statement in the book that long before human beings invented compasses, animals enjoyed ingenious built-in compasses, along with an inborn capacity to read the compass. And you say they, in effect, perform these incredible mathematical computations. And in the process, you talk about pigeons and monarch butterflies and dung beetles and so forth. But these navigational processes are just spectacular, particularly when you get to the monarch butterfly. A butterfly that takes up to three generations, oftentimes, to complete the journey. And then they're able to go to the exact tree. If they're flying from wherever they're flying from to Mexico, they're able to go to the exact tree that their ancestors went to. I mean, this in itself is an incredible story of animal navigation that is hard to believe. And perhaps you can elaborate on that. Also, pigeons, and I'm thinking about dung beetles as well, who can detect polarized light from the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. I mean, this in itself is mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, it really is amazing. You know, when I first started reading all of this, I was just shocked that these animals have these kinds of capabilities. Having myself worked on aircraft navigation systems and knowing how complex and sophisticated they are, and then when you read about what is going on within these animals and how they're navigating, it's just astonishing, like you said, how an animal can have such a sophisticated capability. One of the examples you mentioned is the sun compass, but there's several. We talked already about the magnetic compass, which I think most people are familiar with. A number of animals use the sun as a source for a position, which intuitively makes sense. But then they also, another aspect of the sun that a number of animals use is using the polarized light from the sun. In other words, the sun as a compass is great on a sunny day. Of course, it's useless at night. But on a sunny day where you can see the sun, yeah, you can use it. On a cloudy day, there's a problem with that. But there's a number of animals that are actually able, even on a cloudy day, they're able to detect the position of the sun. And the reason they're able to do that is because they can detect the polarization of the sun, because as the sun's rays are transmitted through the atmosphere, they become polarized. When they're first transmitted from the sun, they're completely unpolarized. People familiar with polarized sunglasses, where you use those to block out the intensity of the sun, well, something somewhat similar goes on in some animals where they're able to detect the polarization of the sun, again, through the clouds without even seeing it directly. And then based on that polarization, they're actually able to infer the direction of the sun. It took me a long time studying this to even understand how they actually, you know, in a theoretical terms, how it even works. But it's a complex process. And again, it also involves a number of aspects of mathematics. The other thing to make this even more complicated is that if you're using the sun in some way to infer a source for your navigation, you have to take into account the fact that the sun is moving throughout the day. It's not stationary, right? So animals, somehow they have encoded within their brains, they have an algorithm that they're able to actually compensate for the movement of the sun throughout the day. And there's been a number of experiments that have demonstrated this capability, that if the sun is at a certain location at 8 o'clock in the morning, an animal can detect that and use that to determine its navigation path. But then as the sun moves later, 11 o'clock in the morning, the animal knows that the sun has actually moved physically through the sky over those preceding 3 hours and actually compensate for that as it computes its navigation path. It's just amazing.
It is. And you think about the dung beetle. I mean, when I was reading about that in your book, I was astounded to read that they can detect polarized light from stars in the Milky Way and that use that as a basis for a compass. And as I'm reading this, I'm wondering, how can intelligent people believe that these kinds of navigational processes could have evolved through a blind and purposeless evolutionary process?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the big question here. When we think of systems like that that involve, and there's two aspects of it that stand out to me being an engineer, is one is just the engineering aspects of a number of these navigation systems. There's a lot of complex engineering that has gone into how these systems have developed and how they're built into the animals. That's one aspect. The other one is, again, basically the mathematical aspect of these are algorithms. And again, and particularly in the case of navigation, they're mathematical algorithms where you're actually doing some computation. And it involves, in some cases, just simple geometry, but that's, when I say simple geometry, it's simple maybe to us, but it's not so simple for an ant. Or if you talk about other cases where you brought up the Arctic tern, some of these birds that do these really long distance migrations across the Earth, one of the things that they do is they're able to compute the shortest path. So an example I like to use for this is when you look at a flat map of the Earth, and if you're flying in an airplane from New York to Tokyo, they're roughly at the same latitude. So you would say, okay, the shortest path is just fly west. Well, when you look at a globe, it turns out that's not the shortest path, right? The shortest path that actually takes you from New York flying almost over the North Pole to Tokyo, that is actually the shortest path, and those are what we call great circle routes. Well, it turns out some of these long-distance migrating birds actually fly those same kinds of paths. They're able to fly these great circle routes, giving them the shortest distance between the starting point and the end point. So when we do that, that involves sophisticated mathematics. It's specifically spherical geometry. Well, these birds aren't doing spherical geometry like we can do, but there's some mechanism in their brains that's actually functioning the same way as if they're doing these sophisticated mathematical calculations, and we have no clue as to how that's possible.
The one thing that kept going through my head as I was reading through your book is the words of St. Paul where he says, God's eternal power and divine nature are clearly seen through what has been made, and so we are without excuse. And I think to some degree, even in an age of scientific enlightenment, we have become wretched flatlanders. We're stuck in the psycho-epistemological cocoons of our own obscurantism. We're looking at things but not seeing the brilliance in those things. And you're taking an ant and a dung beetle, of all things, and through these small creatures, you're demonstrating that something majestic is going on. We're, as it were, walking through the wardrobe into Narnia. We're seeing things that suddenly we didn't see before, and I think that's so beautiful. Oftentimes, I fear, and I'm certainly guilty of this myself, that we're not outside. We don't see the majesty of God's creation.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that. I think speaking just for myself, as I've studied this element of biology over time, I became much more appreciative of how just the simplest things that you see every day, or at least if you're observant, you would see every day, there's aspects of design that are obvious if we only take the time to actually, you know, study it in detail. And that's one of the things that drew me to this subject, was that a lot of this research actually has only been done in the last, I'll say, 50 years, in some cases less than that, where scientists have actually taken the time to try to understand what's going on with many of these animals and how they're exhibiting behaviors such as this. Previously, people believe that, you know, animals were just all simple robots, and they exhibited, particularly these less developed animals such as insects, that these were robotic behaviors and they had limited repertoire of behaviors and they didn't think it was that complex. Well, turns out that's not the case. you find more and more as they study these behaviors, they find just how complex these behaviors are. And the aspect of this that I think really stands out to me is that, again, that the fact that a lot of these behaviors are occurring in animals with really tiny brains. And we think of humans, we think, okay, we've got these giant brains and we have all this neural capacity. We have, you know, tens of billions of neurons, and gives us a lot of flexibility in behaviors and be able to think. Well, that's one way of thinking about things. But when you look at these animals, they do not have these giant brains. They don't have the ability to really think in the sense that we are. And yet, somehow, these behaviors that are complex are programmed into these brains. And one of the aspects it demonstrates to me is how it requires such a high degree of design intelligence to even conceive and implement such a design in brains that are so tiny.
Design intelligence. I want to go back to the loggerhead sea turtles. Again, this is the image that you have on the cover of your book. And one of the points that ought to be elaborated on is the fact that the females, they don't become sexually mature until they're 20 to 30 years old. And then they're able to migrate back to the same beach where they were born, lay their eggs, and that somehow or other is imprinted as well in this brain. It's imprinted in their memory. So they can find something 20 or 30 years after they're actually born, go back to that same place and lay their eggs. I mean, that's astonishing in and of itself.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. When they're born and they're hatched, as soon as they hatch, they immediately travel to the ocean and then swim out to sea. Well, somehow in this process, immediately after they're born, they have some kind of information that's imprinted based on their navigation sensors that tells them where that beach is located. And then, like you say,
this is like 30 years after they're born. I mean, it's just astounding.
Yeah, again, that's another element to this that we're really clueless as to how that even is possible.
One of the things that you bring up somewhat tangentially, and I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, but you mentioned global climate change. And it seems, at least by reading what you've written about this, that that is less of an existential threat than during the most recent ice age.
Yeah, that's an aspect that caught my curiosity as I was thinking about how these animals are, and particularly the long-distance migrating birds and the monarch butterfly. So in the case of the monarch butterfly, for example, it migrates back and forth. Like you say, it actually takes several generations, but the population moves from, well, there's several different populations, but in the one that most people are familiar with is the one that migrates from eastern Canada to a part of Mexico. But during the last ice age, obviously they were not residing in Canada because it was completely frozen and it was glacial. So I wondered about where were they migrating during the last ice age. I haven't come across any information about anybody that's done some research into this about where they may have resided during that period of time, but it gives you an indication that they actually did adapt. During the last ice age, they survived somehow. We don't know where, but they did survive, and then now we're past the last ice age, and then they migrate, you know, where they do between Canada and Mexico. But and there's a lot of other examples that are very similar to that, where animals obviously change their migration patterns. Which brings up another question about all of this. And like we talked about earlier, many of these migration routes are actually in some way inherited. In other words, the offspring are born knowing where to migrate to. Well, if that's the case, how did they adapt over time with climate change, because, again, the most recent significant example being the Ice Age. How are they able to change their migration patterns if it's actually somehow contained within their genome? We really don't know any of this about how that's even possible.
You have done engineering work for NASA and the FAA. You've been a consultant, and you point out in the book that if you compare the most impressive instances of animal navigation with the most advanced navigational systems of modern aircraft, you recognize a process that is top down. There are numerous reasons why this is top down and structured, and I think that's worth elaborating on as well.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the, again, one of the reasons I became interested in this topic and thought it was instructive to address. And that is, from an engineering point of view, anybody who's worked as an engineer or even a computer programmer knows that in order to develop a system or a software program, it's a top-down process. You have to start with some higher-level goal, some purpose for the system, and then there's a number of steps that you go through to develop that system. And the same is true, well, again, my experience in particular with navigation systems, but other engineering systems that I've worked on as well, but it is a very structured, top-down process that you have to follow. And if you don't, you end up with mistakes. You end up with something that has design flaws in it. There's a recent example of this with the Boeing 737 MAX, where there were obviously some mistakes made during the development process of that system that ended up in two aircraft crashes. And so that's unfortunately a negative example, but it illustrates the point that when you have these complex systems, you have to go through a very rigorous, strict, top-down engineering process. A couple of aspects of why that's important. One is these are integrated systems. In other words, there's different elements to the systems that are involved. So in the case of navigation, you have sensors, you have a control system. In the case of aircraft, you have a flight control system, but in the case of animals, birds, they have their own flight control system. And then you have the actual algorithms themselves that are controlling the entire process. All of that has to be integrated. Otherwise, it's going to malfunction. And another word we use in engineering is coherent. They have to function coherently. In other words, work properly together. And again, the examples that keep showing up now in some of these animal systems indicate that these are highly engineered systems that actually rival the engineering that's involved in developing aircraft navigation systems. To me, that's one of the most amazing aspects of all of this.
So let's go back to the honeybee again. They have these specialized structures in the eyes and the brain to see polarized light. And thus, as you're explaining, they're able to navigate by that. And that brings up the issue of the coordinated development of the eyes and the brain and how evolution tries to account for that. So I oftentimes thought about the human eyes. Darwin called them organs of extreme perfection and complication. So I'm looking around as I'm speaking to you, and I'm sure you're looking around as well. And as we do, there's this vast number of impulses that are traveling from our eyes through millions of little nerve fibers, and they're transmitting information to this complex computing center in our brain called the visual cortex. And without the coordinated development of the eye and the brain in synergistic fashion, the isolated development of either is not only meaningless, but counterproductive. And I think that's sort of what you're alluding to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, it's interesting that Darwin actually addressed this issue in certain aspects. He discusses this issue of form and function. In order, for example, for a behavior to occur, you need two things at minimum. One is the form. You need the physical mechanisms to actually execute the behavior. like a bird flying, for example, or a fish swimming. But then functionally, you need some control mechanisms that actually perform the function or control the function. And Darwin wrestled with this, and he, in the end, he kind of dismissed this as not a significant issue. But as you alluded, it's not an insignificant issue because, particularly in the case of behaviors that we've been talking about, you have these different physical elements, and then you have what I'll call software elements, like things that are residing in an algorithm, for example. Well, it doesn't do much good to have one without the other. You could have a physical element capable of, like, for example, a bird having some navigation sensor, but if the bird does not have the algorithm to actually use that information to navigate, it's useless. And so how you can explain the origin of all of these different aspects developing through basically a random step-by-step Darwinian process in a holistic, integrated manner, to me, seems highly implausible.
You know, one of the geniuses of your particular book is that it's so interesting. I mean, you can get caught up in the technicalities of all of this, but you're constantly pointing to different animals like the ant or the beetle or bees or butterflies or the loggerhead turtle that we talked about. And then you're telling a story about each one of these, and you're opening our eyes to the complexities that are involved and just the majesty and mystery of these animal algorithms. I want to just emphasize that for a moment because I want people to get your book. And by the way, your book is available to anyone that wants a copy just by supporting the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. So you can go to the web at equip.org and simply ask for your copy for your support of this ministry. But the genius of this book is the animals themselves. It's not complex. It's just intoxicatingly interesting. On the back of this book, it says, as a blurb from the Discovery Institute, how do some birds, turtles, and insects possess navigational abilities that rival the best man-made navigational technologies? Who or what taught the honeybee its dance or its hive mates how to read the complex message of that dance? How do the blind mound-building termites master passive heating and cooling strategies that dazzle skilled human architects? Well, in this book, you get a sense of how all of that takes place. And I think that's the intoxicating nature of the book and one of the reasons that people need to read this book. Because, again, when you read this book, the one thing that keeps going through your brain is, oh, my Lord, how majestic are your ways. You just revel in the majesty of God. Here's another example that you talk about in your book, the wasp. And the amazing ability that a wasp has to paralyze its captured prey. Doesn't kill it, but paralyzes it. And there's a reason for that. And how that sting accurately is made between two distinct plates on the underside of a bee's neck immobilizes that bee so it can be used as food later on.
Right, yeah. I mean, again, it's one of those behaviors that is really difficult to explain, developing through some random mutation, trial and error kind of a process. Because in the process of the wasp executing this behavior, it's so exact that, okay, you could have a wasp try, you know, 100 times to perform this maneuver. Well, chances are, okay, maybe it might get it right 1 out of 100. Well, how does such a behavior develop and evolve? You know, that seems like such a highly improbable thing to occur through a random process. Yeah, it really is hard to explain.
Another thing you talk about in the book is complex program societies, and you've alluded to this, but if we consider the ant again, the species live in groups and they exhibit this complex behavior that's associated with social group lifestyles. So they're able to have this division of labor. They have caste. They have consensus building. They utilize symbolic language. So you have these complex social behaviors that appear to be programmed, and not programmed arbitrarily, but top-down programming for the very start.
Yeah, exactly. And again, these insects that reside in these, some people call them, in some cases, superorganisms, because you have a colony of ants that sometimes consists of millions, literally millions of ants that reside within the colony. But yet the colony as a whole exhibits behaviors such that the ants are able to carry out the proper behaviors at the proper time. So again, whether it's foraging for food, finding another nest, tending to the queen, tending to the pupae, there's a number of different behaviors that the ants perform, but it somehow is all coordinated, but there is no master coordinator for the colony. In other words, there's not some top-down mechanism that's directing the ants to do the behaviors that they need to do. These are all basically independent animals. One way of thinking about it is now in the world of artificial intelligence, right, and people have actually developed these drones that perform different kinds of things, flying drones in some cases, and they're able to in some ways replicate what a large group of animals might perform, except that you're talking about an electromechanical drone programmed through artificial intelligence. But they're all independent actors. But in the case of these social colonies, there's a programmed control of the individuals, in this case ants, such that each ant is actually making its own decision about what behavior to perform at any particular time. But it's all coordinated such that, you know, some group of ants will do behavior A, another group of ants will be behavior B, et cetera. And all of that is programmed into the brains of these ants somehow in this really complex algorithm and controlling the behavior of literally millions of animals within the colony. Again, it's just amazing.
And as you say, it would be the envy of a corporate manager. Even the altruism of termites is fascinating, and you write about that in the book as well. So this is particularly interesting and I think informative, instructive in that Richard Dawkins talk about the selfish gene, and yet you find altruism in termites where they will fight off army ants and they'll give up their life for their fellow termites in the process.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the animals aren't all selfish, as Dawkins, you know, simplistically likes to view evolution, where animals are behaving in a purely selfish manner for their own existence or the existence of their offspring. And a lot of these social colonies, animals such as some of the ants, actually do exhibit altruistic behaviors where basically they're sacrificing themselves for the good of the colony. It's one of those aspects of this that's, again, a bit of a challenge for our Darwinian point of view.
Something else you write about that I found fascinating is insect architecture. So these structures built by animals that human architects are marveling at in the present.
Right, and I think you mentioned earlier the termites that build these amazing termite nests, which are really these giant mounds. And there's a lot of engineering that goes into the construction of these nests because they have a number of different elements to it. One of them is controlling the temperature. They're able to actually control the temperature within the nest, which is important because they can only exist within a certain temperature range. And then there's ventilation systems. They build ventilation systems. Aspects of the nest include being able to drain water away from the core parts of the nest. They actually, in some cases, we have animals, some ants, that do farming. They actually are able to farm and use that crop that they grow, fungus type of crop, typically, that's used as a source of food. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects of this. One of the most fascinating ones that's really interesting to look at is a particular species in Australia called a compass termite. They build these really large mounds, and because Australia is located in such a hot climate, and these mounds are in the interior of the continent typically, they have a three-dimensional design such that the narrow face of the mound faces the sun, and the wide face of the mound faces away from the sun. So it, again, it's purposely designed to minimize the heating of the mound due to the sun during the course of a day. Again, it's a really sophisticated engineering design.
So you say a social insect, like an ant or a termite, is the closest to a talented human architect. And again, just to recapitulate what you said about termites, they have nests that can reach more than 20 feet high, that include a royal chamber, nurseries, gardens, waste dumps, a well, a ventilation system that reduces heat and removes carbon dioxide. And these termites are blind. And then, as you just alluded to, they include roofs with eaves to keep water out of the nest. And I thought the most fascinating thing that you wrote about this is that the airflow design of termite nests was the inspiration for the world's first all-natural cooling building structure in Zimbabwe.
Right. Yeah, I was really surprised when I read that. There's a whole field now in science called biomimetics, where scientists and engineers take something from the world biology, typically an animal, or from the microbiology, where they're able to analyze a system that exists and take that principle of how that system is designed and apply it to a human design. And that, to me, is a perfect illustration of that.
We would be remiss if we didn't talk about spiders. You're right about spiders. And obviously, when we see a spider web, we can so glibly look at it and then look away without recognizing the absolute majesty and the fact that these spider webs are custom built. They're not one size fits all, but they're custom built. And, you know, the different kinds of silk involved in building these spider webs and the strength of this silk. I mean, it's just amazing, as you have articulated this in the book.
Yes, exactly. Humans have been trying for years to replicate the construction of silk. And, you know, they've come close, but in fact, they've never been able to fully replicate a material that has all the properties that silk has. It's really amazing. Silk is constructed of a number of different proteins, and the process for manufacturing silk, again, when we're talking about ants, that is a complex process, and obviously it has to involve a number of genes in the genome. And these proteins are complex proteins, actually. And so the way that the spiders use it is they're actually able to produce different kinds of silk, because when they construct their webs, they actually use several different types of silk depending upon what part of the web they're actually building at the time. So in other words, they have, you know, the basic outline of the web, but then there's a number of different things they use the silk for. One of them is sort of what we would call a kind of a guy wire. And then there's also silk that the spider itself uses in addition to the web to maneuver around. So anyway, there's a number of different types of silk depending on what the need is. In other words, the strength and flexibility that's required for the function of that piece of silk within the web. It really is amazing how, again, this is all programmed somehow in the spider, how to use the silk. It knows what silk to produce for which part of the web at which time. It really is amazing how all of that is orchestrated in a spider.
And how does a spider locate the prey?
Well, yeah, that's another really interesting aspect. The spider is able to detect the location of a prey three-dimensionally if a prey actually gets caught in the web. The spider is able to sense the location based on the information it gets, in other words, the feedback it gets from the silk within the web. So, in other words, it changes the vibration pattern of the...
The kind of silk changes the vibration pattern?
Right, exactly.
That's because, incredible.
Yeah, just like a piano string, for example, they have different vibration characteristics. And the spiders are able to sense that.
That's a mind blower in and of itself. You have an epigraph in your book. It's by Richard Dawkins, and I want you to elaborate on this. Dawkins says, "What lies at the heart of every living thing is not a fire, not warm breath, not a spark of life. It's information, it's words, it's instructions. If you want to understand life, don't think about vibrant, throbbing gels and oozes. Think about information technology." I mean, this seems to be an incredible admission on the part of Dawkins.
Yeah, I find that interesting because Dawkins does, in many cases like this one in particular, where he does recognize the existence of complexity and design. You know, he talks a lot about design, obviously, in his writings, but he doesn't really follow through on analyzing, okay, well, what's the ultimate origin of design, or in this case, information. He just kind of, you know, dismisses that as a problem for Darwinian evolution. And in the book, I go into a fair amount of discussion about the work of William Dembski and others about the problem of information in biological systems. And the work of Dembski and others is, a lot of it's based on this concept of no free lunch. In other words, there's some algorithms that mathematicians have developed where they're able to demonstrate that you basically, in the terms of information, you don't get something for nothing. You can't just create information ex nihilo out of nothing. And there's plenty of material that exists, published material in academia and others, that have demonstrated that that is the case. You really cannot just generate information out of nothing. And in particular, when you examine a Darwinian process where the claim is made that, in fact, a random process of random mutation and natural selection actually is capable of creating this kind of information that we're talking about, but really, when you examine the work that's been done by people like Dembski and others, it's a claim that really has no basis in fact. It's just a reach to claim that you can create, for example, some of the algorithms that we've been talking about, creating them basically from nothing. It's a big problem for Darwinian evolution.
We know of only one source of functional information, and that's intelligence. I want you to talk about something that you elaborate on in the book as well, and that is the evolutionary biologist that often is relegated to citing the great unlikelihood of the same trait arising in multiple lineages, and how that is improbable. It's improbable that exactly the same evolutionary pathway could ever be traveled twice, much less three or four or a million times.
Right. And that, again, this is another one of the big challenges for Darwinian evolution. And that's this concept that they call convergent evolution, where a characteristic will show up in organisms that they know to be completely unrelated, so it couldn't be common descent. So that's been a problem that's been recognized, at least for a long time. In physical terms, when you look at the fossil record, for example, going back over millions of years, where they see characteristics, physical characteristics, indicating where organisms have a similar kind of characteristic that they know they're unrelated. So that's been a challenge. And what I talk about is how you have the same kind of a challenge that's obvious now in regard to animal behaviors, where you have behaviors that show up in completely unrelated animal taxa. That, again, the problem is that Darwinians just use this term, oh, it's convergent evolution. Well, it's a term really without any meaning. The part of that that they use to actually try to explain it is this concept that they call selection pressure, meaning that there's pressure due to natural selection for these characteristics to occur in different animal groups in this case. Well, again, that's another sort of a fallacious argument where, first of all, a lot of Darwinians don't even agree that there's this nebulous concept called selection pressure. In other words, it's a fallacious argument logically because they're saying, okay, there's something in the environment that's creating this theoretical pressure for an organism to evolve in a certain way. Well, the more you think about it and examine the whole concept, it just kind of falls apart. The only aspect of this that I give any credence to is the work that some people have done in the so-called Evo-Devo world, where there is evidence in some cases, for example, in the case of birds, let's say, if you have an animal that's going to be flying, there are certain characteristics of wings that are necessary and other aspects of the animal, in this case a bird, that are common. In other words, you have certain wing designs that will be sufficient for flight. Well, you can, at least conceptually, you can think, okay, well, that's going to constrain the evolution of an animal that's going to fly, that their wings are going to have pretty similar characteristics. So that's somewhat plausible, and you can say the same thing about fish in terms of the fin designs, etc. But in the case of like the animal behaviors that I talk about, many of these complex behaviors, there's really no constraint. There's nothing constraining the way that such behaviors could or would develop. They're entirely independent. There's nothing forcing a behavior to occur in one group of animals in a similar way to a completely unrelated group of animals. That just isn't the case in terms of these behaviors. So this whole idea of convergent evolution and selection pressure, I don't believe even apply to the things that I've talked about.
As you're talking, Eric, I can't help but think of the fact that we hear this mantra over and over again, particularly in an age of COVID, follow the science, follow the science, follow the science. We hear it over and over, ad nauseum, ad infinitum. And I think it is important to follow the science, but if you really follow the science, will you arrive at the twin pillars of the evolutionary paradigm?
Well, that's the big question here. And I think really the more fundamental question there is when you say follow the science, what are you defining as science? Mm. So the problem that I do talk about a little bit in the book is this whole notion of naturalism. The problem is that the reigning paradigm within science today is naturalism. So that the explanations or the allowable explanations that can be given for the existence of something within science has to have a purely naturalistic explanation. You can't invoke other causes, supernatural causes, something that you can't measure physically. It's really a materialistic point of view. And that's where we're stuck at, for the most part, within science. And that's why something like intelligent design is basically ruled out from the beginning, because it doesn't fit within the naturalistic, materialistic worldview.
You also point out that the evolutionist is conflating survival and arrival, survival of the fittest with arrival of the fittest, and I think that's worth a comment or so.
Yeah, and I think more specifically how that relates to the topics in my book is trying to explain the origin of things that are novel, and in particular, in this case, novel behaviors. This is another big challenge for Darwinian evolution, is explaining the origin of completely novel, in some cases, body designs, like those that took place during the Cambrian explosion. That's a challenge there. And in this case, we're talking about the origin of completely novel behaviors. And how can a Darwinian process be a reasonable explanation for that? And some of the details I go into in the book address that. And one set of examples relates to the social behaviors that we talked about. There is actually a fair amount of research that's gone into the genetics of the social insects. And what they have found, in fact, is that the insects that live within social colonies do exhibit a significant number of genetic, and there's different terms for this, but in some cases they call them orphan genes, and there's different variations on that. But basically what it means is that there's novel genes that show up in the genomes of these social animals, as opposed to these animals that basically live solitary. And we're talking about hundreds and, or in some cases, thousands of either novel or highly modified genes. Well, again, that is a significant challenge for an explanation from a Darwinian point of view, to explain how such huge changes in the genome could occur through a step-by-step, mutation-by-mutation process.
Yeah, you know, intelligent design is something that you talk about quite a bit in the later chapters of the book. Evolutionists who are committed to the rule known as methodological naturalism are always insisting that this competing explanation, I'm talking about intelligent design, must not be considered. And so you say that this particular predilection on the part of evolutionists renders evolutionary theory not an inference to the best explanation, but less impressively, an inference to the best allowed explanation. In other words, intelligent design is simply dismissed. It's not allowed. You can't consider the best explanation, but you have to follow their rules. And their rules eliminate what is the best explanation. In fact, I think one of the most insightful aspects of your book is a chart. And I usually don't like charts a whole lot. I don't know why. I just don't like charts. But you have a chart, figure 7-1 in chapter 7 of the book. And in that chart, you're comparing blind evolution with intelligent design. And you've got like 10 different categories. And there are only three of those categories in which blind evolution has some plausible explanation, such as intelligent design would. But most of the categories cannot be accounted for, at least with real intelligence, when you're looking at blind evolution.
Yeah, again, like you said, that is the fundamental problem here, that those that are advocates of Darwinian evolution and biology basically try to rule out other explanations that don't fit their naturalistic, materialistic worldview, and they use that as the pretense for ruling out any consideration for intelligent design. But, you know, I think what we're finding over time is that fair-minded people are coming to a different conclusion, that it's really sort of rigging the game by ruling out other explanations such as intelligent design in the first place and not even considering it. It is interesting that, not to go off on a tangent here, but there are a number of people in the world of biology and related sciences that have recognized for quite a while now the limitations of Darwinian evolution. And so a number of evolutionary biologists have been proposing what they call this extended evolutionary synthesis, where they've tried to bring in a number of other mechanisms that they think might be plausible to explain evolution. And I discussed some of those a little bit in the book, but for the most part, those have actually failed. They are interesting. There's some research going on in different aspects of that that show some promise, but really, for the most part, all of these other processes that they've proposed really fail as explanations. And so hopefully people are waking up to the fact that Darwinian evolution, based on this philosophy of naturalism, is inadequate, and they need to start looking at other plausible explanations, and hopefully including intelligent design.
There's sort of a phobia that is present in the world today, and I don't know if you coined this word, but I love it. You talk about teleophobia.
Yeah, it's funny. I just happened to stumble across that word in my research. I don't even remember how now, but what I was finding is that evolutionary biologists, and actually not just them, but a lot of people in biology and in a lot of the sciences, they purposely avoid using the word purpose, and in particular the word teleology, which means purpose. And they'll go through a lot of mental gymnastics to avoid using that word because they don't like the implications, obviously, because it means if there is some purpose in some aspect of biology, well, where did that purpose come from? Right? That raises a whole other set of questions that they don't even want to deal with. But examples of where they end up going with this and why it's a dead end is because, and there's actually been books written about this whole issue, a lot of research in the literature about it. What they'll do is they'll say, okay, what's the function of the human heart or a heart in an animal? Well, normally you say, well, the function of the heart is to pump blood throughout the organism, okay? Well, they won't even say that. They'll say, no, the heart evolved over time as a process of mutation and natural selection, and because of selection, it evolved in a certain way to pump blood throughout the organism, completely obscuring what the ultimate purpose of the heart is. And they've just completely obscured the meaning of the word, not just purpose, but function and goals. They don't even want to talk about any aspects like that. And that's why I ended up applying the word teleophobic to the people that are thinking this way, because they're afraid of actually talking about things like ultimate purpose in the Aristotelian sense because of the implications.
I want to go through a bit of a lightning round with you to end this podcast, and it has to do with common objections to intelligent design. Let me just enumerate some of them as you do in the book and then get your quick response. So one of the common objections to intelligent design is it's religion. It's not science.
Yeah, that's a fallacy. The work that all of the people that have been working on intelligent design, for example, the work of Mike Behe, Steve Meyer, others, if you examine their work, it's all science. There's not a religious aspect to the technical work that goes into their research and their arguments. It is science.
It's following truth wherever it leads. The National Academy of Sciences notes that intelligent design is not a scientific concept because it cannot be empirically tested.
Yeah, and that's not true. One way of thinking about it is in a similar way that evolutionary theory, they examine the fossil record. Well, the fossil record is an empirical way of examining the history of animals throughout time. That's empirical. In the same way, those of us working in ID are doing the same thing. And again, all of the information and research described in my book is based on empirical evidence.
Another objection, ID is a, we've heard this over and over again, ad nauseum, ad infinitum, it's a science stopper.
Right, the accusation is that, okay, you say the explanation is ID, okay, then we're going to stop doing research because there's no longer reason to research that particular aspect of science any longer, which is just a fallacious argument because, in fact, I would argue that the truth is the other way around, because take the example we talked about a few minutes ago of convergent evolution. Well, in many cases where there's an observation made about some common characteristics in different organisms, and Darwinians will just say, oh, it's convergent evolution. Well, that's a science stopper right there. They say, well, then, okay, there's no reason to investigate that any further. But in the case of intelligent design, typically what we're trying to say is, okay, we have some indication based on observations that something is designed. Now, let's go research this farther. Let's find out, okay, what's the genetics behind this? How did this aspect of some organism develop? What's controlling the genes? How is the behavior, for example, programmed into a brain? That's actually inviting more research.
Here's another one. Intelligent design appeals to teleology. It appeals to purpose, and that's not allowed in science. It's verboten, as your German friend Gunther Beckley would put it. It's forbidden because the goals or purposes that you're alluding to have no place in biology. They only have a place in the study of human behavior.
Yeah, again, that's back to the same problem of not allowing the discussion even about some higher level goals or purpose when talking about biological systems. But it's just, again, it's a fallacy that, in that case, that one actually does lead to a dead end in science. And again, a different example here would be these insect social colonies, where there really is some higher level set of goals and purposes that are designed into the function of these social colonies. Well, if you're not even allowed to talk about that, you're stopping science at that point. So, it's a really fallacious argument.
Yeah, that's well said. Another objection, intelligent design is false because if it were true, then each animal would be perfectly designed by an omnipotent, all-wise God, perfectly designed to function with 100% efficiency within its ecological niche. This is, I think, particularly interesting, something you talk about in the book that we haven't discussed on this podcast.
Yeah, there's some history to that particular argument. It goes way back to prior to Darwin, where the reigning paradigm, obviously at that time, was basically young Earth creationism, and that all life on Earth was created relatively recently. And so the implication of that was, if God was the creator and God is perfect and he's going to create all of life that functions perfectly, that therefore there would be no design flaws in that creation, or in this case, organisms. Well, there's a couple of problems, right? One is that the science now is telling us that young Earth creationism is not supported by the evidence that, in fact, life has existed on Earth for quite a significant period of time, millions, if not billions of years. So that's a long period of time. And so the way I would push back on that argument is twofold. One is, even if organisms were created a long time ago in a perfect manner, well, as we know with things like climate change, over time the environment changes, and an animal that was designed to function in one environment will not function as well in a changing, different environment. So that's one reason that it could change. The other reason, and one aspect of evolution that actually is correct, is the fact that genomes do have mutations. So they actually do degrade over time. So that actually causes a degradation in the function of an animal, for example, and will cause, you know, not to function as well as maybe it did previously as it degrades over time. So there's different ways of refuting that particular argument.
Another objection, suboptimal design. And this is something I've talked to your colleagues, William Dembski and Stephen Meyer, about. And the answer that you give in the book, in part, has to do with constrained optimization. And I think that's a concept that people have to get in their minds in order to be able to refute this particular objection.
Yes, exactly. I think this is a little bit of an understandable argument that some people give, because not everybody's an engineer. But those of us who are engineers perfectly understand this issue, because whenever you design a system, and again, as we talked about before, when you're designing a system in a proper manner from top down, you make design trade-offs all the time. And you can see that in anything that's engineered, for example, an automobile, airplanes, particularly complex devices where there's trade-offs in terms of energy, efficiency, speed, you know, a lot of different aspects. You have to make trade-offs because you can't perfectly design something to function in 100% way in every aspect. So you make a trade-off. Well, the result of that trade-off is, okay, something may function really well in one aspect, but not quite as well in some other aspect. And that's just physics. There's just nothing you can do about that.
Let me just mention one more. We haven't covered all of the objections that you cover in the book, but one of the objections that I want to end with is the objection of the problem of who designed the designer. So there's a thought in the minds of people that if you have a designed universe, then you have to have a designer of that designed universe. And then the question is, who designed that designer? And then you have an infinite regress.
Yeah, and again, that's a common objection that some people use. Richard Dawkins in particular used it in his book, The God Delusion. That's a philosophical and theological issue that I didn't want to go into too deeply in the book, because there's plenty of other philosophers that have addressed this, like William Lane Craig. I highly recommend his writings, but there's plenty of other ones that have addressed that particular issue. Again, it's really a fallacious argument.
It is. And so many of the arguments against intelligent design are not well thought out. And I really appreciate the fact that you give the objection and then you give a cogent answer to that objection. I think is helpful to everybody that reads your book. But what's most fascinating about this book to me is the actual insects that you talk about. It opens this Lilliputian world of enormous complexity and design that cannot be explained away by blind macroevolutionary processes, animal algorithms, evolution, and the mysterious origin of ingenious instincts by Eric Castle. This book, available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute, it's a must read. It's something that you want to have in your library. And you can take, even with your kids, you can take one example and you can start intoxicating them with the mystery and the majesty of something that seemingly is so simple as an ant. And when you start to unravel that Lilliputian world in the mind of a child, their minds will be directed in a proper trajectory. I think this book is just ingenious in so many different ways. It's interesting. It's a relatively quick read for the kind of complex information that's going to be opened up as a whole world for you to explore for the rest of your life. And then when you're outdoors or even indoors and you see some of these creations, you'll look at them through different eyes. So I really deeply appreciate the work that you've done in this regard.
Well, thanks again, Hank. I really appreciate your comments and humbled that you're so supportive for the book. I'm really thankful for your support.
Well, it is with the entirety of my heart that I support this book, Animal Algorithms. You can find a copy on the web at equip.org. And I think if you've followed Eric in this podcast, I think you'll want to read the book. And you certainly will see him as one of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people, particularly as it fits our mission statement. And there's so much that is being said about this podcast. It's very humbling, but it's not about me. It's about my guests. One of the comments that I was reading just before I came into the studio is on a previous podcast in which we discuss why the future of civilization depends on true religion. Everything else is a derivation of the faith, true religion. It was my discussion with Dr. Scott Hahn, and someone wrote about this, that this podcast just keeps knocking it out of the park. And again, that's because my guests keep knocking it out of the park, just as Eric Castle did on this edition of Hank Unplugged. Thanks for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you next time with another edition of Hank Unplugged. So long for now.